Today's episode is sponsored by John Paul the Great Catholic University at Escondido, California. St. John Paul II had a deep appreciation for the arts, and you may know that he was even an actor and a writer himself. He understood how influential storytelling and art can be on our culture, really having the power to move people's hearts towards God. Inspired by this call, John Paul the Great Catholic University is forming the next generation of creative professionals who will be bringing truth, beauty, and goodness to the entertainment industry. People who enroll can study film production, acting, animation, screenwriting, music design, and even video games. If you want to foster your God-given creative talents within a supportive and faithfully Catholic environment, we encourage you to explore JP Catholic's program and scholarships. JP Catholic is offering our listeners a full application fee waiver, which you'll find at jpcatholic.edu/herald. Pursue excellence in your creative craft without sacrificing your values. Visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. Perhaps you're not actually looking for a degree, but instead you want to sharpen your storytelling skills. JP Catholic also offers free online courses, such as a crash course in storytelling. Learn screenwriting from Christians who work in the industry. Whether you're interested in a full degree or free online classes, visit jpcatholic.edu/herald. That's jpcatholic.edu/herald, as in H-E-R-A-L-D. Welcome to Merely Catholic, with me, Gavin Ashenden. Canon George Conger is to be found in Florida, where he is an Anglican parish priest. But after an illustrious intellectual career and training, he also became a journalist, a writer, and a broadcaster. He's written for every journal of religious repute you care to name, and runs a podcast that has a following throughout the world. He's one of the most authoritative voices on Anglican and Episcopalian affairs today. He's got a judgment that people look to as the years go by to reflect what's really going on in the Anglican world. And so, as we came to the end of the archiepiscopate of Justin Welby, who better to turn to than George Conger, who's been watching all the Archbishops of Canterbury for the last few decades, in order to ask him to sum up the calibre of Justin Welby's archiepiscopate and the state of Anglicanism he leaves behind. George joins me now. Well, George, this is wonderful. You and I are old friends on the screen, and we've done lots of things together, but I'm probably introducing you to an audience that doesn't know how lucky they are to have the benefit of your skills and your analysis. You're an intellectual, you're a theologian. I say that because you've been trained at the very best universities. You're a journalist and you're a parish priest. There's not a lot you aren't, really. But George, we're going to discuss Justin Welby because we both know him quite well as observers of Welby. Both of us have been commentating on church affairs publicly and privately for some time. And I'd like to say that both of us have had the judgments we've exercised in public mainly validated. And I'm particularly interested in yours. I mean, you're particularly good at this kind of thing. And you're doing it from America. You're an authority on the Anglican Communion. So thank you for joining us. George, tell us a bit about your background so the people who don't know you can just get a sense of who they're listening to.
Well, I'm coming up on 30 years next year of being a priest in the Episcopal Church of the USA. I am that rare breed, a conservative Episcopalian who is very happy in my work and my ministry. I'm in Central Florida. The Episcopal Church is not monochrome by any means. Its hierarchy may be uniformly liberal, but you go from Anglo-Catholics to Pentecostals across the United States in the Episcopal world. Having said that, I was the senior correspondent for the Church of England newspaper for about 20 years. I wrote for the Living Church magazine, which is an Episcopal publication, for about 10 years. And my work has appeared in The Guardian, The Telegraph, The Washington Post, The Times. As a freelancer, I've been on the BBC a few times as a commentator. And I was, for about 6 or 7 years, a staff correspondent for the Jerusalem Post. So I would supplement my income while I was a graduate student and as a curate by writing. And I've just stayed in the habit. And for the past, well, since 2014, I've been an editor of a website that I run with another friend named Kevin Coulson, who Gavin was a partner in one of our ventures. And so I think I've written about 5,000 or 6,000 articles over the past 30 years in about focusing on Anglicanism. I've known each of the archbishops, almost all the primates. I've been to all the meetings. I'm one of the guys holding up I'm the doorstop at a lot of these things.
Well, so full disclosure, you and I have worked together. We like each other. We trust each other. And I'm very glad to have the opportunity to do this with you and through you, because I'm always afraid that having left the Church of England, in some part because of the way in which Justin Welby increasingly took the church, but the trajectory was fixed long before him. It's not his fault. But I'm slightly concerned that that there might be some kind of sour grapes or a degree of prejudice or narrow-mindedness in my response. And one of the reasons I'm so glad to do this with you is because I think, as our listeners will discover, you've been observing this a while. You watched Rowan Williams all the way through. You know George Carey. You've seen a few archbishops now. And so Welby's, it's not just Welby. We're putting him into a broader context. George, I've just written an article saying I thought he was the worst archbishop in living memory, and maybe ever. How unfair was I?
You were too kind. There's an odor of sulfur about Justin Welby. What do I mean by that? Justin Welby there's Justin Welby the man, there's Justin Welby the person in the office. If you take a critical look at the things he accomplished domestically, internationally, nationally, in the political realm as a member of the House of Lords, he was a failure. But if you look at the deeper picture of what he represented and what he said, he was destructive in a way that we've not seen since the Reformation times. And I'm not saying that he's an evil man, but there is a whiff of sulfur that has crept into the Church of England. It crept into my Episcopal church 20, 30 years ago, and it's now going very quickly through the Church of England, other Anglican churches. Not to be unkind, but there are elements of the Catholic Church that seem to have that same sense about them, that they are not doing the work of the Lord, they are doing the work of somebody else. And I would say Justin Welby is the worst Anglican archbishop since the Reformation period.
Well, that's exactly the conclusion I can.
And he has a competition where one man during the reign, was it Charles the First, shot his gamekeeper, William Sangster. So, I mean, we've got some competition here.
Well, Jefferson Shorey provides a certain amount of competition from your side of the pond. But the difference is that Jefferson Shorey, or presiding bishop, made it absolutely clear where she came from in terms of very radical feminist liberalism. I think the thing about Welby is that he was presented to everyone as a nice, kind, conservative, competent evangelical with charismatic tendencies who could bring, and no doubt by his appointment, he was designed to bring the whole of the evangelical, charismatic, Anglican constituency with him. And I think that's why he was appointed. I had this image, which is, you know, again, it's very harsh, and I feel anxious about being harsh, as a kind of institutional drugs mule In other words, there was already a philosophy in place through the Crown Appointments Commission that they were going to use managers, people who've been shown to be competent in institutions. And they're all over the place in the Church of England. Now, you could hardly be ordained unless you've spent 15 years serving mammon somewhere on the grounds that, they wanted institutional expertise. And that one of the reasons they picked Welby was that he had no theology to speak of. He never showed himself to be much of a thinker. But he was a middle manager who combined superficial credentials of evangelical charismatic experience, though I was a bit hesitant about how deep they went, with being on message in terms of this new bureaucratic managerial project they had. And therefore, they looked around and they said, who could do this for us? And Welby came with connections with Holy Trinity Brompton, what had become the most powerful constituency in Anglicanism. And they said, he'll do, and he won't ask too many questions. And they appointed him, and he didn't. Can you expand on that?
Yes, Justin Welby had a background as an oil executive. However, there was always, a sense as a young man that he was going to go into the church. He was, as a teen, he was active, and as a young adult, he was active in the Ewern camps, which are the John Smythe scandals. These were the camps for boys who attended the top private schools in the UK, is invitation only. They began in the 30s, and essentially they were a way to create future clergy, schoolmasters, businessmen, lawyers of the right of our sort. In other words, create an evangelical upper class control of the church and just sort of spread the influence this way. Welby was part of that. He was a dormitory officer or a camp counselor, we would say, in the United States. One of the recent stories we had in our publication was that we have people who were contemporaries at that time of Welby, and Welby knew about the abuse scandal that he only belatedly learned about 40-odd years later, seemingly having forgotten that he knew about it. Well, that's a side issue. It comes after...
But hang on, George, it's not a side issue. He shared a house in Cambridge with the clergyman who received the first kind of internal report. I mean, they have breakfast together daily. It's and other people report the fact that they knew that Welby was familiar with the issue. They overheard conversations. So we need to recognize it as a fact that from the 80s at least, Welby was familiar with the fact that John Smythe was beating people, and that when the report landed on his desk in 2012. There was almost nobody better equipped to launch action if he'd chosen to launch action, but he didn't.
It would have embarrassed the side. Damaged the brand. We look after our own. We had gotten, the evangelical elite resolved the Smythe problem by shipping him off to the colonies. In this case, to Zimbabwe.
That was really very weird, but that's exactly what they did, yes.
They shipped him off to Zimbabwe, and then he continued to do that, and then went to South Africa when Zimbabwe fell apart and continued to do it there until he died. And Welby's response was, I don't remember this. I didn't get the paper. It was somebody else's job. And it was only when Channel 4 made a stink of this, I think in 2017, that the church got serious about it, because, and it was squarely in Welby's lap. But Welby comes out of sort of the old Etonian, moneyed, educated clergy track for a specific type of evangelicalism. And when it works, it's wonderful. It's the John Stott sort. And there are other people I would name Rico Tice, wonderful evangelical charismatic people of a certain background and type. Welby was the in that tradition, but he never seemed to exercise the values or the beliefs of that tradition, which is which is almost a sense of noblesse oblige. You know, much has been given to me, therefore much is expected of me. And therefore I have a duty to serve the poor, to serve the needy, to spread the gospel of Jesus Christ, because I have been blessed by material and life circumstances. I must take this out into the world. Welby was happy to be blessed, but Welby was blessed by these circumstances, but his actions throughout his career were to perfect and polish the institution, not disseminate the word of God. So a mutual friend of ours, Jules Gomez, was an assistant of Welby's at the cathedral in Liverpool. And on one level, Welby was an excellent manager. As a pastor, as a moral voice, that just was not what he did.
Let's go. I was going to do this in order of sort of parish, church, Anglican communion, nation. Let's go straight to the nation, because the order of my that I suggest doesn't matter, but it flows on exactly from what you're saying. If he had been in the tradition of the HTB, the Evangelical and Charismatics, who define themselves by being really quite vocal about Jesus and the gospel and the claims of the kingdom. I mean, they annoy the people around them precisely because they won't stop talking about Jesus. And in one sense, when it's done well, it's very lovely, and it's also capable of annoying people. But Welby had a platform like no other in the House of Lords. It's an extraordinary place to be. Obviously, one would have to exercise it with sophistication, with care, with good judgment. But in the whole of his time there, he appears to have restricted himself simply to socialist moral soundbites and almost nothing else, and was surrounded by colleagues over whose appointment he had a direct input who did exactly the same thing. The people in the Church of England said, "We don't hear you talking about Jesus. We don't hear you talking about the church or about salvation or about Christian ethics. We only hear you talking like a Guardian correspondent." I was at a very brief interview, lasting about 15 seconds, with a Guardian correspondent. And she spoke for about 5 minutes about how pleasing Welby was to her because he embodied all the values that she stood for. And I thought, well, she has summed it up better than I ever could. If he gets that kind of plaudit from her, completely uncritical, and she says, "He's one of us, he spoke like one of us, he performed like one of us," that kind of proves the case, really. Why on earth wasn't he able, even by implication, to bring something of his faith into his public role?
Well, if you look at the hard numbers, the House of the Bishops of the Church of England voted in lockstep in opposition to the Cameron government, and have been quite keen supporters of the new Labour government. The basically, to a man and a woman, are Labour bishops. They're supposed to be crossbench or whatever they call it. Mm. There was a recent debate in the House of Lords where Archbishop Cottrell gave a speech on community cohesion. A lot of blather about let's be nice to everybody. It really will not be remembered by anybody. Well, one of the lords who stood up to respond was a former conservative, a life peer, had been a minister for Northern Ireland in the Cameron government, and he said, "I really don't want to talk about what did. I want to talk about the failures of the Church of England. You people tell me that because we don't, that sending immigrants to Rwanda violates God's law, but then you go off and push these things that violate clear biblical statements about God's law." So essentially he eviscerated Cottrell, saying that, you know, you're top heavy in management, you have too many bishops, you have too many middle managers, you don't support the clergy, and the messages that you give out are just the latest popular thinking from the Guardian opinion pages. And Cottrell's answer is, "Well, we need to talk in private." And that was it. And this is what Welby presided over, the creation of of an episcopate in the House of Lords that did not offer moral guidance, but party politics. Mm. Now, if there was an issue where there was a moral question involved, the Church of England was by and large absent from it, except in a rote way. Now, they did speak out on the recent euthanasia bill, but it didn't quite... they had so spoiled their platform that nobody really cared. If you spend a generation talking about labor, you know, the problems of labor councils and whatnot, and garbage sanitation and this and that, nobody pays any attention to you when you have moral issues. And the advertising point, the bishops say, well, we need to be in the House of Lords to give a moral voice. Well, they weren't there. They're in the House of Lords because they were the great landowners in the Middle Ages. And they're just hereditary peers who haven't been tossed out yet, who now are by and large of a certain political hue. But taking it back to Welby, he sort of perfected this sense that the church was the bien passant, you know, guardian, editorial writers at prayer. This is what he did. And the net result is that there are serious calls to take the Church of England out of the House of Lords. Mm. Now, I don't, as an American, I think they should be out, but it's not my country, not my business. But the good that could have been done, somebody like George Bell, who was the Bishop of Chichester during the Second World War, stood up and condemned the firebombings of German cities, saying we've moved from targeting industry to dehousing the German worker force. And in doing so, we are taking the war to people. Whether or not that was good strategy, I'm not going to address. But the point is, here's an example of a bishop doing something and raising a moral issue that should be discussed. We don't have George Bell's would be impossible for a George Bell to arise, or a William Temple, or the moral, intellectual heft and caliber where somebody could speak to the nation is gone.
They'd be,
or is not present.
Long before, yes, I think that's true. Let me take you to parishes. There's a very strange thing happened a few years ago, just very recently, something called Save the Parish Movement. Now, Catholics won't... So the Anglicans and Catholics share a lot of language and nomenclature in common. But actually, Anglican bishops and Anglican parishes are very different legally and also theologically a bit from Catholic ones. So there's this tension in Anglicanism between episcopacy and congregationalism. The Church of England, I would say, is theoretically episcopal, but pragmatically congregationalist. So parishes have an enormous amount of autonomy. Clergy often complain that if the church wardens decide something, there's very little they can do. They can be completely hampered by them. Parishes decide how much money they're going to send up the chain. They can't be compelled to pay their quota. And sometimes they fail for bad reasons. Sometimes they refuse on principle. But the parish is the engine room of the Church of England. And to lose the support of the parishes or to demoralize them to the point where they can't work would be one of the most managerially incompetent things that you could do. And yet, I mean, there are two examples, I think. The commitment to net zero that the Church of England General Synod produced means that elderly lady church wardens who want to keep themselves warm in winter so they can come and say evensong are forbidden from replacing their boilers, because the Church of England is somehow trying to compensate for coal-burning power stations in China. Although the church commissioners have enormous sums of money, they've chosen, Welby has done something quite extraordinary. He began to change the rules and unlock the water flow from the church commission his investments initially for his own projects. But when he chose to commit himself to give away millions in reparation to sixth generation slaves, in the face of historical evidence the Church of England actually never benefited from slave investment in the first place, the whole thing became a combination of virtue signalling and disastrous internal relationships with the parishes. The parishes said, many of them, if you've got the money and you're going to give it away instead of allowing us to repair this very precious fabric, how can we possibly believe in you? Whose side are you on? What are you doing? He'd never been a parish priest for very long. It seems to me single-handedly he did more to demoralise the parishes under his notional care than anyone else I can think of in history, which is one of the reasons why, non-hyperbolically, I think he may be the worst archbishop ever. Is there anything remedial I've missed, George, we can say on his behalf in terms of the parishes, or are there other things?
Clergy morale is at rock bottom in the Church of England. I know this from many friends I have who serve in parishes. It's at rock bottom, and the reasons for that are the priest is the United States in the South. I live in Florida. I still live in Christendom, where there's a residual respect for the cloth. So no matter what denomination you represent, you are treated differently. That's absent in England. When I went to study in the UK, it was one of the first things I noticed. It was, you know, the role of the clergy is very different in England than it is in the United States and in other parts of the world. So the old sort of, well, if I'm not being paid very much, I still have the professional reputation that sort of bolsters my ego. So you're badly paid, and you're not looked up to anymore. So that's been long in coming. Second, the workload is increasing. The most extreme, because the number of clergy are being reduced and the number of middle managers and staff are being raised. The most extreme case is recently the Diocese of Truro, which is,
yes, that's right,
Cornwall. It's extraordinary. Had, I think, 31 stipendiary clergy and 26 diocesan staffers, or some. I may have enough, but it's almost, there are many, almost as many people in the office, environmental officers, women officers, ecumenical officers, gay and lesbian officers, net zero officers, you know, ad infinitum, drones. I have a friend who is a warden in a parish in the Diocese of Exeter, and his wife is they have two children in their youth group, his children, and his wife, who's the youth group leader, is being made to take all these courses and file all these reports. And basically half of her time as a youth leader, volunteer youth leader, is filling out forms for safeguarding for her own children. And so to get people to volunteer is now a very onerous task. You all have to be retired. You can't have a work, a career and doing a job if you want to be a church warden anymore. There was, you raised that case in the Diocese of Derby, where the boilers went out, and the diocese said, no, I'm sorry, you can't replace them unless you spend literally millions to, you know, redo everything. And so now, if you go to that church, you have to wear your coat on the inside. And the reason was the diocesan net zero officer said, no, we're not allowing you to do this. Because even though the wardens control the flow of money from the parishioners, the property is owned by the diocese, by the Church of England. So you can't really, you know, if I wanted to knock down something or build something, you know, it's fine with the diocese so long as I don't pocket the money or encumber it, the money, and run off with it. But in England, the control exercised by the church over the property is in tension with the actual income flows and people who actually pay for the upkeep and everything. So it's a system that's not working. And so you have too much work. You have too much bureaucracy. You have bishops who seemingly are more interested. Take it back to Derby. That's the case where you had the school chaplain who preached a sermon based on the doctrine of the Church of England. He was accused of being a security threat, as if he were an ISIS member, and his bishop didn't back him in the tribunals, and still hasn't returned the license, even though all he did was preach the official doctrine of the Church of England. The morale is at rock bottom. And then you have, of course, the abuse scandals. Now, the abuse scandals are few and far between if you look at gross numbers, but it's like what happened in the United States. We had 10 years there where the 1% of pervert priests sullied and demoralized the 99% of the men who did the hard work of daily parish life. Because they too were such, you know, there's some guy who's been, you know, I hate to put it this way, but for a Catholic audience, the Church of England has a McCarrick problem too.
Yes, it does. Yes.
Of groups protecting themselves, of similar inclinations. I don't want to sound like a nut job, but we have groups who are basically Freemasons. Freemasons look after each other, and there are known. We had a man who was a known proud Freemason. He became a bishop. He said, "Okay, I'm no longer a Freemason." Well, now he's quietly crept back into being a Freemason.
It's incredible.
And yes, and as the appointments hit the appointments he makes, gosh, there's an unusually large number of Freemasons, and yes. And so there are the McCarrick circles, and then the Freemason circles, all these things coming together that on the parish level, the work of pastoral care and celebrating the sacraments and teaching and preaching the gospel is secondary to form filling, quotas, diversity. Why is this parish in the wilds of Herefordshire not hiring a Black Anglican minister to serve the minority congregation in the community? Well, there are no minorities here. Oh, we are racist. Why don't you have, you know, this many people? I know it sounds silly, but this bureaucratic mindset is so destructive. And who's been pushing it? The men at the top. The agendas. They set the speed. They set the direction.
It's not you who sound silly, it's what you're describing that's silly. I mean, it was incredible to me that this Save the Parish movement, begun by a delightful man called Marcus Walker, who has a vicar of St. Bartholomew's in London, but surrounded by some very competent, he's also competent, but some very competent middle-class Anglicans who are in despair about the pressures that parishes were coming under and the demoralisation that you talked about. You've talked about the clergy themselves, but also, of course, the wardens and the people. I mean, surely the birth of a movement calling itself Save the Parish is a terrible indictment upon the whole episcopal care of the parish.
Because it's Save the Parish from the national church.
Yes, that's right.
Save from the Wellesley. Parish from the church. Yes. It's not Save the Parish because we need money to keep the roof from falling in. It's Save the Parish from the predations of the bishop and church house in London. And you've nailed it in one, that the enemy is the central organization. And for many competent priests, if they have any career ambitions, you don't cross that.
Absolutely.
You pay you pay a career price if you follow your conscience as opposed to following orders.
Well, I wouldn't know anything about that, George, but I dare say you're right. And let me take you to the Anglican Communion, because you're very well informed on all the areas we've spoken about now, but of all of them, you're probably best informed about this. It's again, Catholics won't understand, but I think there are 42 provinces. They're completely autonomous. There is an absence of authority. They come to the table, each as valuable as the others. They vote, but in some strange hangover from English colonialism, the Archbishop of Canterbury gets to be the unchallenged chairman of them. Now, I spent quite a lot of my adult years as an Anglican clergyman watching Rowe and Williams do the most extraordinarily sophisticated stalling job in the Anglican Communion. I thought to begin with it was incoherence, but after a while it became clear that it was a very clever policy of sophisticated inaction. When Welby took over, the sophistication disappeared. Again, many people won't understand that we've moved from, if you like, the historic tribalism of Congregationalists and Puritans at one end, Anglo-Catholics at another, spiritually minded socialists who we'll call liberals in the middle. These have been the three tribes of Anglicanism. They've partly replicated themselves across the rest of the world, not perfectly. But that all changed with the whole advent of identity politics and gay rights. Rowan Williams, although he was a liberal, I seem to remember him being quite discreet about his own preferences. He seemed to me to say, I'm going to be the kind of archbishop who's going to do all I can to hold you difficult teenage children together and not impose my own preferences. We all knew what they would be, but he didn't do it. Welby seemed incontinent. He was unable to hide his own preferences and unable to avoid politically imposing them, and therefore managed, it seems to me, to bring the Anglican Communion to the point of I don't know, schism, dislocation. What state would you say it's in, George? They were about to pass motions dethroning the Archbishop's natural right to chair, weren't they? How bad had it got under Welby?
It's over. How should I put this? Those national churches that represent the bulk of the people in the pews on Sunday have washed their hands of the Church of England in the person of Justin Welby. Nigeria, Uganda, Rwanda. Now, people may say, that's not America, that's not Australia. Well, the great bulk of the church growth of the past generation has been in Africa and in Asia. My diocese has about 20,000 people, active Episcopalians. The diocese of Sarawak and Brunei has 3 to 4 times that. I mean, they're 3 to 4 times that many people in, you know, Borneo, in this similar sized geographic demographic area. Now, with Justin Welby, there arose a degree of personal animosity that was unprecedented. George Carey, who I knew very well and who liked me and I liked him, and he had a very avuncular style. And he was ridiculed by some sections of the Church of England for attempting to be the nation's vicar. Now, that may not have pleased everybody, but he took that to the Anglican Communion. And so he would basically let things take their course, but if it reached a certain point, he would say, well, no, this is what I believe, and this is what the Church has taught, and we're not going past that. And in fact, what you're stating is contrary to scripture, tradition, reason. So George Carey would present, he was a very fatherly figure. Rowan Williams, when he came in, had a different approach to things. He was on the opposite side than George Carey, but he believed that we needed to have a system, and his goal was to build the system so that it would work. And that meant him holding back from his own personal viewpoints so that we would have Nigerians mad at Americans, but they felt that Rowan Williams, each side felt that he was on their side. They wanted him to do more, and he was good at masterly in action. And he took early retirement from the job because I think it just wore him out. And then Justin Welby came in. And as you say, Justin Welby came in with a great deal of enthusiasm from the evangelical wing in the Anglican world. Was here's somebody out of Holy Trinity Brompton, an alpha guy. Well, he wasn't. He was a middle manager. He would tell some, basically money would be used to threaten some provinces. If you're a poor African province that, I'll give you an example. The Anglican Church in Algiers is happened to be on the property of the British Embassy. And the British Embassy over the years has basically said, oh, it's now ours. And the church in Algiers is growing because there are people moving up from sub-Saharan Africa to Algeria on their way to Europe. And so the church is doing ministry among those people and they'd like the church back. Home Foreign Office said no. And so, well, the Archbishop Munir Anis went to Justin Welby, can you put a word in for us? And Welby's response was, well, I'll do this if you do that. And the request was too onerous, so they went to Michael Nasir Ali and had him raise this in the House of Lords. In other words, Welby was a businessman, a bureaucrat. And then he was found not to be straightforward in his answers. He was a liar. One archbishop told me he was a liar. And a degree of personal animosity has arisen where this past year, the Global South, there are two groups, one's called GAFCON and the other's called the Global South Fellowship of Anglicans. There's interaction. They're basically, you can say they're one the same in one end of the same. Some are part of one, some are not, and so on. But at the end of the day, they have proposed that the first among equals, the primus inter pares, be elected from among the archbishops themselves by the archbishops and not given default authority to the Archbishop of Canterbury. And this was fought viciously by Welby through a combination of, well, we'll study it in a commission, we'll talk about it over the next at the next Lambeth conference in 10 years, so on and so forth, as well as personal arm twisting, don't you dare do this. So, for instance, Welby's minions, his aides, went down for an election of a new archbishop in Mozambique, and it was between a Welby man and a Global South man. The Global South man won running away. But Welby would send his people to influence the elections of new archbishops in these poorer, more marginal places so that when you had the crowd together, he would have a group. Well,
did they
that's
carry
failed.
Cash with him, George? Was the influence actually, I mean, the Americans have certainly been accused, Tech, of offering to fund various projects of the diocese. Did Welby go
well,
that far?
In many ways, the national churches mimic the government policies. The United States does throw money around. We'll send you this money if you do X. And with Donald Trump, it'll be even clearer. I mean, it'll be absolutely clear that's how it works.
Yes.
The British are not known for throwing money around, but they're throwing, but we'll use our influence for you. Or would you like your son to go to a university in the UK? We can make it happen. So it's not as cash heavy, but it does achieve the same results, different ways of British diplomacy versus American diplomacy.
Yes.
And Welby used the traditional British diplomacy of, I'll get your son into the LSE for achieving church ends. I'm getting too deep into the weeds here, but the end result was Welby was rejected by the archbishops as their leader. Not all of them, but it was a total sham, it's total fiasco. Now, one of the little problems is that you get new art every time they meet. There's always a third of them are brand new, because, you know, people become archbishops in their mid-60s and they retire by the time they're 70. So they really only have a five-year lifespan. We don't have 20-year archbishops as you would in the Catholic Church or something. It's, you know, to get through the system, you're usually much older. So Welby's always been able to start again, ground zero, with every new meeting, with the brand new people telling, trust me, here's what I'll do. And by the time they've finished their 4 or 5 or 6 years as an archbishop, then retire, they've had it with him. But we've got new people. I've seen it happen for, you know, I've been doing this for 30 years. I've seen it happen again and again.
So he's demoralized the parishes. He's overwhelmed the institution with bad bureaucracy. He's lost the nation by being politically partisan. I think one of the things that really surprised me was when it came out that his preferred candidate to be Bishop of London, we got an administrative nurse, a nice lady who was very good at nursing, less obviously theologically competent. But we have just had a scandal of the most awful proportions. It's to do with post offices and the people who ran the post office destroyed the lives of their managers by having them prosecuted for criminal theft when actually it was a software glitch. It's taken about 20 years to come out. The ruthlessness, the unkindness, the incompetence of the managers in the post office has taken the breath away of the general public, to say nothing of the injustice. And yet one of the senior bureaucrats was a woman vicar called Paula Venables. And it turns out that she was on the short list to become Bishop of London. And she was Welby's preferred candidate. The scope, words begin to fail me at this point. How could Welby possibly exercise judgment as catastrophic as that? It's beyond. I mean, one would also. It almost looks like as a critic once made it up, but it's not been made up.
Gavin, I'd like to take it to a deeper level, and tell me if you want to stop. But one of the things, as I've noticed over the years, if I've been to primates' meetings, if I've been to some of these bishops, there are archbishops and bishops who are godly, righteous, holy men, and yes, one or two women. And I can remember going to a primates' meeting in Alexandria, and there was a break time, and there I see the bishop of Archbishop of Argentina, one from Uganda, and one from Rwanda, all sitting around couches, and I know them all, and I say hello, and they turn to me and say, George, we're about to pray. Would you like to join us? And so we just prayed for a half hour together, not for any specific thing, not, you know, we're going to pray that this happens, but rather let us stand before the Lord and be present to God. Now that may be those were three evangelical bishops, and that may be part of their tradition, but I know Catholic bishops, Anglo-Catholic bishops, who are the same way, and I've participated in that sort of thing with them as well. That is something that many of these primates, when they want go to these meetings, want to do. They want to spend the bulk of their time before the Lord, not before an agenda that was written for them, and the minutes have already been written for them, for a meeting. Justin Welby never he was a poser, a spiritual poser. He would, how can I know what's in another man's soul? I don't. I can only look at the fruits and the outward signs of it. But Justin Welby would not be one to sit down and just pray without having an agenda he would not be one who would seek to find God's will through scripture, meditation, you know, reading, you know, what did Augustine have to say about this issue that I'm wrestling with? There was a singular lacking of, whether you call it theological or spiritual, holiness in him. And sometimes, and I jokingly started off the show by saying there's a smell of sulfur in the air around the Anglican Church and the Church of England. Because the Lord wasn't front and center, Satan steps in. And you ask, how did Paul of Venels get on the short list? Well, because that would have destroyed the Diocese of London completely. Yes. And who wants that to be done? I'm sure the enemy wants that to be done.
George,
am I sounding like a crazy American from the swamps?
You're sounding like a good and competent and well-informed Catholic, George, if I can return the compliment. George, I don't remember any of the archbishops I've seen release photographs of a sort of magazine style of laying down their crozier. I didn't even know it was a thing at the end of their tenure. On Monday, Lambeth Palace produced some beautifully lit, professionally enabled photographs of Justin Welby looking thoughtful, fingering his crozier as he laid it down. George, it's not a thing, is it? It's never been done before. My first thought was, you've just resigned in shame for personal and institutional failure. How is it you can pay a photographer to present yourself as some kind of film star martyred archbishop? The whole thing just, it was as ludicrous as it was immoral, I thought. But it hasn't happened before, has it?
No. There's no rite or ceremony. And believe me, we've got prayer books and books of occasional services and alternative service books. And if it was there, somebody would have found it.
That's right.
And I'm sure it's not in the Roman Missal either that somebody might have picked up to.
I don't think it is. No.
Well, this incident for me, in my opinion, again, I cannot speak to the state of his soul or conscience, is an example of being a poser.
Well, that's why
We got an Instagram message and a Twitter X message and press releases saying that the Archbishop spent his final day at the Eucharist and then, you know, in prayer and contemplation. Then he had a ceremony laying down his crozier. Then he ended the day with Compline. And there's these pictures of him looking pensive and prayerful. Meanwhile, what is not said that he had three catered affairs that same day, lunch, a high tea, and a dinner in the guard room in the Great Hall at Lambeth Palace, where he was finishing up, he basically was honoring his social obligations. So if you wanted actually a true measure of that last day, you would need him with a glass of Chablis.
So it's a gap between presentation and substance. And basically he was partying, but he presented it as
holy,
wounded sanctity. As holy. Yeah. Incredible.
Now, and this, if I may offer an anecdote, it doesn't involve Welby, but it does involve this problem that we see within the Anglican world. I remember in, 1998, I was at the Lambeth Conference. It was the first one I covered as a journalist. And I actually was also one of the staffers in the sense that I helped do training and all this and that. Well, at that time, there was a terrorist attack. Islamists set off explosives in Dar es Salaam, Tanzania. And then there were the next day, a terrorist attack in Nairobi, Milton Islam. Well, there was a spontaneous gathering that was just shared at a meal. After dinner tonight, come to the chapel at the University of Kent, and we will pray for those who have died, and we'll just seek God's wisdom. And so we've got all these African bishops, several hundred, plus some Americans, Australians, there's some English bishops, I remember, I can't mention because he became a Catholic, but
unspeakable.
Richard Broadhurst, John Broadhurst, John Broadhurst. He was one of them, and everybody's in there, and you know, kneeling, praying, several hundred people, plus staffers, wives, whatnot. Then across the other way, as we're sitting there in silence and praying, I hear the clink of cocktail glasses and party music. And I sort of look over, and there's a cocktail party being offered by the Americans that have sort of most of the British clergy, most of the British bishops, the American, you know, I mean, the liberal group were having their, so there's, you know, those sort of sounds of like silly women's laughter and clink of glasses and music in the background while you're, you know, trying to pray for the soul of somebody who's just killed by a terror attack. And all I could think of was that scene from the movie Dr. Zhivago, where the peasants are standing outside the ball, you know, in the snow, watching things. And that sense of the change in Anglicanism I had in 98, that the oppressed peasantry are going to basically drive the aristocrats out of power. And this image that I still have this to this day, that, you know, Justin Welby's pretending to spend the last day in meditation, contemplation, prayer, you know, repentance, Lord, I have fallen short in my job, I have sinned, forgive me, help me, you know, find the right, was a sham, and instead we're having cocktail parties and canopies.
I think that sums it up. George, thank you so much for being so generous with your time. Before you go, Catholics get very excited about Papa Bele, the new pope, the new conclave, and we're already beginning to thoughtfully look ahead. Give us your short list of candidates to replace Welby and a thumbnail sketch, if you don't mind.
It's just as bad as a short list for the who would replace Francis. Well, the educated opinion is that that they want a woman. And the women candidates are, we have the Bishop of London, Sarah Mullally, that she's not going to take it because she has a scandal just as large as the John Smythe scandal. That's the scandal where she essentially allowed a gay vicar to be hounded to death until he drove her to commit suicide. And there was a coroner's report that essentially said that just gross incompetence and malfeasance. So that's going to bite her. She's not going to go there. There's Rachel Trawick, who's the Bishop of Gloucester, who did a dreadful job of recently. She was on the BBC, and basically it was her time to sort of campaign, and all she did was repeat platitudes and truisms and more of the same Welbyism. In other words, she's a Welbyite. She'll continue the process. We have Helen Ann Hartley, the young woman who has stood up to Welby and Cottrell, and very liberal, very bright, but she is not going to go anywhere because she's
a whistleblower.
She's a whistleblower.
Yeah.
I hate to be vulgar, but she's the only one with balls in the House of Bishops.
Not the first person to share that insight.
Rose Hudson Wilkes is a suffragan, but she is also a professionally angry black woman, and they may choose a professionally angry black woman. I've known her since I met her at a World Council of Churches meeting in Porto Alegre, Brazil, 99, and she was crazy then. In the
George,
feminist stuff?
I was at Harare. What year was the Harare World Council of Churches?
98, I think it was.
I remember watching her whip up the Nordic Protestants into a fury of feminist rage, saying such anti-ecumenical, visceral things that she got the whole of the Orthodox delegation to walk out in disgusted and demoralized protest. She's not exactly a sensitive ecumenist.
No. And so those are sort of the people that like to beat, that the press likes to put out if you want to go punters. But the real candidates are Graham Usher, the Bishop of Norwich. He's a liberal Catholic. And if they do the tradition of going from left, you know, Catholic, evangelical, it's their turn. Right. He's in his mid-50s. There's no dung on his shoes. He's a affable, well-spoken person. There is Martin Snow, the Bishop of Leicester, who is an evangelical and who has been tasked with trying to get the Living in Love and Faith process through the General Synod to allow gay prayers. If he succeeds, his reward will be Canterbury. If he fails, his father was a bishop, I think, or his brother. He's a clerical family. And the third person, so the real three is the Catholic Graham Usher, the evangelical, liberal evangelical Martin Snow, and the Bishop of Chelmsford.
Also from a clerical family, and a name I can never pronounce. It's got Def and Tuckney in it.
Def Tani Francis. Gully is a first name. It's a diminutive of a Persian first name. Her father was Bishop of Iran, an Iranian. Her mother's English. They had to flee Iran. Her brother was murdered when the Ayatollah came to power. Her father was a convert from Islam. She is an inoffensive 58-year-old woman who is liberal, who hasn't done anything wrong, hasn't done anything right. But if they just basically want a person who can, I think she'll be chosen. Gully Francis de Cani, Bishop of Chelmsford, which is the Eastern London into Essex bit. And I hate to put it in that sense. There are more qualified, more competent, but what is considered, they're all three, Snow, Francis de Cani, and Usher, are Welby creations, who basically the company men, company women. And getting a little deep into this, but the problem is that the Church of England hired about 15 years ago the wife of someone who was a bishop, who had been a former PR human resources manager, I think British Gas.
She was an HR resources mid management in British Gas. She was indeed, yes.
And the old way was allegedly that you would be surprised by being plucked out. She changed it where you basically started fast-tracking people and sort of sending them to courses. And no, we don't really. Being in a parish is too long is a hindrance. Having a theological education is a bit of a hindrance. Oh, you've only been a priest for 6 years, but you spent 20 years at the post office as a manager? Wonderful. You're a nursing manager? Wonderful. You were this and that. And so a whole generation of clergy became bishops who are essentially mediocre bishops. Not bad, not good, but no George Bell's man during the Second World War. No Rowan Williams, no George Carey type working class, you know, boys who made good and studied and, you know, played by the rules and rose through the ranks on merit. That system's all gone. It's now the middle class Guardian reading, Channel 4 watching. Oh, I'm being dismissive. I shouldn't be.
Well, I think you're being descriptive.
The Holy Spirit is noticeably absent from that.
I think you're being descriptive, George. But thank you so much for giving us such a tour de force. I mean, you really are one of the most experienced people in the business, and your judgment is constantly proved right, which means if anyone has a spare £10 or $10 to invest with the bookies, they're probably onto a sure thing. George, it's been such a pleasure to talk to you.
Well, I did choose Justin Welby and Catherine Jeffords Shorey.
Did you really?
Yes, I did. But I got this last one wrong in the United States. Sean Rowe, a tubby white male, I thought had no chance just because there was a Hispanic, a black, and a woman.
If you'd scored all three, we'd have accused you of insider trading. I think two out of three is a sign of your integrity. George, thank you so much for doing this. It's been really great to talk to you again. And people will be very grateful for all you've contributed. Bless you and thank you.
What I'm trying to say is that this is a spiritual war that the Anglican world is engaged in. And Justin Welby's was on the wrong side. One of the great tragedies of the Anglican world is that they've lost people like you and Michael Nazarelli and John Broadhurst. I wish people had stayed to fight the good fight, but sometimes that people have to realize in their circumstances, that's not what they're called to do.
I think it is about vocation, and that's another conversation we might have it one day. George, you've been very generous. Thank you very much.
I hope I was able to give you what you needed.
It was just fantastic. Thank you. God bless you and thank you.